Friday was my third script. Damn! I wrote two scripts before that. It wasn't too good, but Friday was the right script at the right time. We had saw so many movies that came out depicting our neighborhood as hell on earth. Even Boys in the Hood, Menace to Society. We didn't see our neighborhood like that. We saw it as a fun place to grow up. Of course, it had its dangers, but for the most part, it was fun.
What's up, big pun?
So we wanted to do a movie that reflected the fun we had with all this crazy stuff going on.
Because it's Friday, and you ain't got to do.
McGee, new month, new theme. I forget who we have to thank for this one, but 420 Stoner Month here at MM Dub. What are we thinking?
I mean, I like that we're starting the theme halfway through the month, but
still a lot of month left. It's just pretty early in the month.
There's a lot of month left. It's a long one. What a better one to celebrate.
With our 420 theme, Stoner Month, we want to talk about the subgenre of films centered around the cannabis culture, its use, its effects, its rituals, and the kind of misadventures that tend to follow. At their core, these films tend to share a few defining traits. I'm going to spit a few at you, McGee. Let me see if you agree. Cannabis or drugs as a catalyst? Yay, nay? What do we think?
I mean, it's a classic for a reason, I think.
Right? Loose episodic storytelling. I feel like that's a pretty well-rounded structure, or not well-rounded, but a little loose structure tends to be for these more like illicit type of B-movie grindhouse cinema, a little more loose storytelling. Okay. What do you think?
Specifically like the kind of like weed genre is usually, I also put it hand in hand with like the road trip as a genre. I feel like there's a lot of overlap between the two.
I feel like you can have a little bit of sunshine that doesn't feel like a weed movie, though. I mean, I there's definitely, your Cheech and Chong that feel like a, but there's definitely road trip movies that don't feel like drug movies.
Yeah, I'm not saying every road trip movie is a weed movie, but there's a lot of the Venn diagram, like the circles overlap quite a bit, I think.
Okay. Laid back or chaotic protagonists. No way we can, got to find some common ground there, huh? Feels like
The
laid-back, chaotic variety. A heightened absurdity and a counterculture ethos. That rounds out the elements. It feels like that builds out our month. What are we thinking?
I like it. I like it. That fits with my thesis as well.
To sum it up or surmise it, a stoner movie is less about the weed itself and more about the worldview, slow, sideways, skeptical of structure, and open to absurdity. And what better way to kick off our the 420 special here at MM Dub with a little old pod favorite, McGee, little Hilo.
Your love of the halfling's leaf has clearly slowed your...
McGee, according to the Complex Magazine Oral History of Friday, which we will include with the show notes, it's a really fun read. It just kind of carries you throughout many members of the production staff and actors talking about their experiences on the film. I believe it was done in 2004, but don't quote me on that. We'll have it in the show notes for you to click down there. But heard a lot about the improv nature of this film lately, McGee, right? Cube actually has a quote. He attributes a number. He actually puts a number on it. I will let you know that I myself have read the script. We're going to play a little peep the script throughout this episode. I will say the draft that I have comes from May of 94, specifically May 26 of 94. So there are a lot of interesting things that, you know, are present here that have changed, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
But he does give a number, right? About how much of this film was improvised. Want to ask you, higher or lower, 70%? Based on you seeing
this,
please.
Is this Cube's number or the real? Like, is this you
Cube's
comparing
number.
It, or is this is what Cube says?
So what he says in the oral history of the Complex magazine, blank was improvised in the film. So having seen it several times yourself throughout this week, what is your guess? Higher or lower, 70%?
I mean, the real number's almost certainly lower. What I'm trying to figure out is Cube, who's he trying to give credit to when he's saying this? Because it's either he's saying like,
that's interesting,
these such strong comedic actors that they were just coming up with shit on the fly all the time, or he's got the writers back and saying like, no, we pretty much stuck to the script. I don't see him.
And it, I don't see him doing it down the middle. Produce along with DJ Pooh in this film, Red, who gets his chain snatched a few times. So is QB, is it some self-flagellation here, or is he trying to big up some Chris Tucker breakout talent, John Witherspoon, Forever Cemented? What do you think?
I think specifically with that in mind, I'm going to say higher, just because I think that he's giving the credit elsewhere more than he's taking the credit for himself.
That's interesting. You're wrong. 60%. But I thought he would be ascribing that's I guess he would be saying lower to accredit himself. It would be higher if he wanted to pick up. No, he says 60. So about a little more than half of the script. And I will say, based on
He's still kind of giving them credit, though. He's giving them the bulk of the credit and still taking his chunk for. I think that's fair. That's the diplomatic answer, which I think is still probably too high in reality, which I'm excited to find out about in this fucking episode.
All right, welcome to Make Me Watch. We're a couple of filmmakers who are forever students of cinema on an eternal quest to watch more movies. I'm your host, E, and I'm joined by my co-host, Sean McGee, who I'm going to get high today because it's Friday. We ain't got no job and we ain't got shit to do. What's going on, brother? How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. How you doing?
Can't complain. Looking forward to this one.
Long time coming.
And this is a show where Sean and I are trading off, forcing one another to watch our favorite films. But before we get into all that, we want to thank you for listening wherever you happen to be listening from. You could be doing anything else with your time. We're happy you're here with us. Follow our socials in the show notes scrolling down there. Please rate, review, give us 5 stars, support us, support your local artists, and join us on Patreon for exclusive shows. Got some entertaining stuff over there. McGee, tossing it to you. What's our first pairing for the 420 special?
Oh, well, I mean, the pairing for this movie specifically that I was thinking, which I'm going to elaborate on over and over the course of the episode, is what I think is my equivalent of this movie, which is Wayne's World. I think this is what I clicked in my head that this was Wayne's World. I had so much fun with this movie. It took me a minute, which we're going
to get
into.
Sound like you're about to say more fun. I'm curious about that reaction before the first and second.
Well, it took me a minute to figure out what was going, like what mindset I should be in, I think. But once I figured it out, I think I had a lot of fun with it. And I think that my reaction to this movie is probably most similar to your reaction to Wayne's World, I feel like.
Party time, excellent. All right, on today's episode, we have my pick for the week. And 95's Friday, we're going to give our overall thoughts up top without spoiling, and then dive into this classic with our world-famous segments that break down the plot, performance, and our favorite behind-the-scenes story. So without further ado, let's get into our review of 95's Friday.
Now, your mama told me what happened to you yesterday. How the hell are you going to get fired on your day off?
Look, she bending over.
Hi, Miss Parker.
Hi, boy.
Miss Parker just don't know.
Come here.
What's up, Big Pine? I mean, Big Worm?
If you ain't got my money, I'm killing you and him.
Drive by!
What's going on?
I don't know. It sounds like machine guns.
So you gonna loan me the money or not?
I wouldn't feel comfortable lending you $200 without a job.
If I was working, I wouldn't need $200.
Exactly.
Now, Dana told me about that big snake situation.
Big worm.
Big worm, big hole, big... I don't give a damn!
Oh, my back, my neck! I'm suing y'all! I want $150,000! But I'll set out of court right now for $20.
Ice Cube, Chris Tucker, Bernie Mac, Johnny Witherspoon, Tiny Zeus Lister, and me along, Friday.
Don't ever, ever...
come by here. Okay?
I love that I almost fucking killed you. All right, that was from the trailer at 95's Friday. Logline, it's Friday and Craig and Smokey must come up with $200 they owe a local bully or there won't be a Saturday. All right, this is starring Ice Cube as Craig, Chris Tucker as Smokey, Tiny Zeus Lester as Debo, John Witherspoon as Mr. Jones, Anna Maria Harsford as Mrs. Jones, and Nia Long as Debbie. We are starting with the titular question, as always. I know you've had this on your list for a very long time, but E, why are you making me watch this one now? In our celebration of 420.
Hell yeah. This is one of God's perfect films, McGee. All right. This is a desert island, lush peninsula, landlocked flyover steak pick for me. This film has probably been
all
my
right,
life.
All right.
Probably since I'm like 8 or 9 years old, I think, somewhere in that ballpark. And it's made such an impression on me that I can like remember the first time seeing the VHS like sit on top of the TV. Like, and we didn't watch it in theaters or anything. It was like a rental or something. But I remember it sitting there in that yellow box like ambrosia for the gods. The memory is...
It just always existed.
Yeah, it's just, there it is. Like, my first memory is just, it's just sitting there.
I think I said that in the Captain Ron episode where I was like, I think that movie just has always existed. So I know exactly the sentiment that you mean, though. Yeah.
This film is of the culture, and its impact and import do not need to be argued. I mean, every single line and every single beat has a rock steady foundation of real shit behind this. And I know this because I have lived this in my own personal life. Every single frame of this film is something I've experienced or been adjacent to. And I believe that's what's so fascinating about this film 31 years later is like how accurately and succinctly Pew and Cube like captured life and made it entertaining and made it flow so casually, but built so beautifully into a well-crafted narrative that like for me builds and what it builds in like subtle ways and believable ways, like what it means to have this like life-altering event happen and then hoping your mom's keeping it secret for you but then realizing she did it like the next second, or a conversation with your pops look like. So much of this film is just ingrained in the culture to where like lines that you could spit could change an atmosphere. I remember one point, one of my homeboys gets into it with a, I don't know if he was Mexican, but you know, he was a Latino dude, gets into it, blah, blah, blah. And then to calm him down afterwards, after like the little breaking up, the little scuffle, I hit him with like, hey, why you don't like Hector? We both laughed and laughed and laughed. And it was a way to sort of diffuse the situation with a movie that we've just been so ingrained with in our like DNA. Mm. Like, I have said bye Felicia to a Felicia during dinner things before. And I wanted to spill.
I'm sure she's gotten that so, just ad nauseum.
Matter of fact, when I said it, she's like, you just wanted to say that. There's no real reason why I needed to, but I wasn't gonna let the opportunity slip by.
you saw the pitch get tossed, and you were like, well, what am I gonna do? Not
since
swing.
I'm here. Yeah. And I wanted to dispel the critique right now that because there's so much looseness or episodic nature to a stoner film, that it isn't well structured, because I believe like maybe the casual fan is looking at this as this film is a series of skits with maybe low interconnectivity, but I believe it to be the opposite. And I think what Pooh and Q put into the script here, like, and let the actor sort of gestate with and sort of breathe life into, is life in media res in maybe the best way possible that I've seen done in these environments, with so much brilliance in the script of like how this story is already happening and feels so lived in, and how circular things, small things will happen and then turn around and then mean the world a little later on. So, for instance, Cube ironing clothes in the morning turns around to his sister coming, Dana coming in later on in the film and asking for the iron, him asking for the $200 and getting another door shut in his face. And we're sort of building on this, like he's unable to get money. And it's sort of, in the after hours, I can't leave or escape the city. We're sort of having this Greek tragedy take place a little bit in the hood here. And this story being so heavily influenced by like Boys in the Hood, but obviously like the flip side of that, the happier side of that, lived in sort of a bit of that is also influenced by earlier films, Hollywood Shuffle, that we've talked about a little earlier in the month, Robert Townsend, and just the independent nature of that film, the comedy of that those environments is what Cube wanted to kind of like bring to this. But I think it's so valuable here. Obviously, lining up with New Line in this sort of Black New Wave of films that they're coming out, and this is being led by Mike DeLuca. Mike DeLuca, a champion of writers, a champion of Black talent early in that '90s, live by the adage that I do cherish to this day, which you mentioned to me all those many years ago about like soldiers will make game of shits in hell, or soldiers will make games of shit in hell. I think that's so valuable here. And I think that's sort of the adage that Cube sort of lived by with this one is like, yeah, things are fucked up, but there's still a lot of like fun here. There's a lot of families. There's a lot of like people like grow up here. There's a lot of, just like normal everyday bullshit. So to show that side of it is what I love about this, because you can relate. He got so so specific that I think it became universal in a way. And I'm hoping that what's it like to kind of be a little older, kind of graduating high school and living with your pops, and then like how that kind of starts butting heads a little bit. That gets real funny. And I think like Cube's early discographies are a lot harder than this if you listen to like his first three albums before we get over here. But they're no less engaging. He's a true storyteller, one of the great American storytellers. And I think the stars aligning here are the three heads of this creative team, Pooh, F. Gary Gray, Cube himself. They collaborate arguably on his most notable song in Cube's career. It Was a Good Day. And where Cube brings sort of like a grounded comedic sensibility, I think moving on, and what you'll see with the franchise, because Pooh's no longer, or is he so much involved? No, Gary Gray isn't so much involved, is they sort of they balance it with a little bit more heart in this film. I think this film has a true sense of family, maturity. We're actually going to get a little bit from Nat talking about the maturity of Cube as we move throughout this film. I may insert it here.
So I had I don't know, it's probably something people have talked about a gazillion times, a Friday revelation, because today I did something a little petty, and then I was like, this is very much like Craig putting the icy drop on the floor back in his dad's glass situation, and then I was like reflecting, and so I was in a mood, reflecting on like weird little petty revenge things I would do as a kid, and just be like, haha, I bent her Pokemon card. And realizing that all the things that Craig does for revenge for the first, like before the fight, are all petty little childish bullshit. Like literally things I would do as a little girl, until he actually like has to take a swing and actually get his ass kicked. Oh, it might be a high thought. Who cares?
But along with that, the fun around this, maybe it is a little broad. There's a little scatological humor here that maybe my past maybe not so vied with those tones so well. But I think I don't know, for whatever reason, this just hits every funny bone in my body, and this has been with me so long that I can quote it without, what am I trying to say? I can listen to it without watching it, know everything that's going on.
Yeah.
It's just, it's every frame of this is ingrained behind my retinas. The language, I think, of the traveling circus of characters and the behaviors that it provokes with these two are so ingrained with me, and like how like the people set themselves up and like invade their space in such a way that I can call out. I know when Felicia comes by, like what these two would do. I know when Debo comes by, what these two would do. I know when Red comes by, what these two would do. When the preacher comes by, it's just like, It feels almost like a docudrama to me at this point. And one last thing I want to say, the brilliance of F. Gary Gray on his first time out, the sound design being used as a joke in this one, the car beeps, the slamming of doors, the music, diegetic, just how just he created a world. He created a slice of life so brilliantly.
Yeah.
I've gone a little long. I will be going on a little longer as we get through with this. McGee, let me toss it to you. Your first time out with Friday, what do we think?
Yeah, I think you fucking hit the nail on the head with what you said. It was like so specific that it becomes universal. Because this is definitely something where it was like, even though it was so specifically lived in and like you said, like built out of real experiences, it's because of that specificity, is that universality of like the like bouncing from house to house looking for the least supervision and like just doing dirtbag shit, like punching each other, like shadow boxing and then slipping in one punch. Or like when they're just walking up the street and he like kicks ankle, yeah, his foot into the back of the ankle or whatever. Like that's such a like just universal human experience, like just like teenage dirtbag shit. That is, it's so much fun to see because it does feel so genuine and from that place of understanding. So like Cube is such an interesting part of this because there are moments where he's just fucking brilliant. And there's moments where I'm just like, you don't even need to say anything here, bro. Like we could just move on. Like we could just, we didn't need that. We could have gotten another, just a take where you didn't say anything, maybe. like, but then there's these other moments.
That I have a compliment sandwich regarding that.
But there's these other moments of just sheer brilliance where it's just like, oh, like there's no way that this movie gets made without you at its core. But there's also parts of this movie where I'm just like, Jesus Christ. But I think ultimately, I had a good time with this movie for sure. And when I compare it to Wayne's World, I do that in the best way possible, in the way where like everything you said about how you experienced this movie is like me growing up, like being able to just hear Wayne's World and see every frame of it in my head is absolutely the same way. And it's like watching this, even though I'm watching it as like, you know, I'm approaching my 40s, we'll just say and put it that way. It's much past the original target demo of when you're supposed to have watched this movie for the first time. But it's like kind of, there's a bridge to me to those moments. You know what I mean? Even though this isn't the language I didn't grow up with, like these quotes specific, I mean, obviously like by Felicia is ingrained in the culture at large. Yeah. Experiencing it in the wild is fucking chef's kiss though, which we'll get into. But in its natural habitat, it really flourishes more than I'd ever heard it before. I was very impressed. But I think that's actually a pretty good summation of my experience with the movie at large, where it was like, I felt like I knew what to expect, but then like seeing it in its habitat was like, oh hell yeah, this rules actually.
I want to talk about a little, how we watched this. Was this one, you know, watching this commercial? Did you dive into?
I watched it on the Movies Anywhere.
Movies in. Oh, okay, nice, nice. Did you catch the special features with this one? Should I?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so if you can, this movie's like maybe $5. I absolutely like. Go ahead and add it to whatever collection you got going, or start one with this film because it's incredible. It's a hood classic, maybe the hood classic. I think the special features are so interesting because you see, and particularly as we get on with the episode and the peep the script, how much on the periphery F. Gary had and what they wanted to do and what they needed to pare down, and how you can, you just start seeing how they sort of nip this and, you know, cut this and we'll bypass this and we'll give this line to that character and we'll let them cook in this little area that it really sort of makes it like bonsai kind of like designed, where they've clipped it enough so we're in, pruned it into, right, into a way that it's like it really turns into something special. So some of the, you know, seeing the director's cut of this film, which is available on the digital and DVD, Some of the Q&A for both the producer and Gary Gray are really interesting on like what went into this. And they really, this is like a 90s production. So they're not, you know, it's not the Puff piece or not it's a more grittier version of a Puff piece. So they're really talking about shit that went, that happened with it that I love and think is so valuable. So highly suggest this one. Before we get into your answer on Blu-ray and who maybe have this on the shelves, I want to hit you with another game, Sean. A little silver screen second. Taking a brief second to quiz one another on some Tinseltown trivia and test our Hollywood insight. We're going to play this one really quick, McGee. We got a multiple choice question for you. What celeb claimed Friday as their favorite movie, stating, quote, "It almost got me in trouble," end quote. Your answers are your selections, excuse me. A, DeMar DeRozan is aka Debo. This is who came up during the beef with the Dre Kendrick. Glad DeMar left. Y'all didn't deserve him either. B, Michael Jordan. C, LeBron James. Or D, all of the above, McGee. They all have a quote.
Well, one of them has the quote.
I'm just realizing that now as I wrote that. What do you think, McGee? A, DeMar DeRozan.
You couldn't think of a fourth option. You know, I was expecting it to be, you know what you would have gotten me with the red herring is if you threw like one white kid in there. Like, give me like, what's the guy from
Jason Williams?
Oh, that would have been funny too. That would have been hilarious. Or I was thinking of the guy from Miami, the Tyler Hero.
Oh, Tyler Hero.
I would have 100% said Tyler Hero if he was in the multiple choice.
Some boy.
Because I know exactly what trouble he was going to get himself in with this movie.
Chet Holmgren or whatever his name. No, not Chet. Yeah, Chet Holmgren.
That's some real. That's a real inside baseball joke. That's fantastic. Okay, out of those options, I don't think it is D Rose because I think D Rose grew up in a world where it wasn't gonna get him in trouble.
Nickname Debo though. I thought it would throw you with that.
And I think that's telling that that quote isn't attributed to him. And it's probably one of his favorite movies, though. I'm going to go with C.
LeBron. Which is, you know what?
Yeah.
You're wrong. But that's the best one. That was the best right here because LeBron claims to love or have seen it. The Godfather shit is gold. And I can't wait to bring that up or use that clip when we get into it later on in the year. Of him being called out for calling out a scene in Godfather that you love. The answer is B, McGee. Michael Jordan. That's what my answer is for Blu-ray on the shelf. Mike said Friday, favorite movie. It almost got him in trouble. He didn't elaborate why. He just told Cube that on one night that Friday's his favorite film. It almost got him in trouble.
That's so funny.
Michael Jordan.
I would have thought, that's my answer for Blu-ray on the shelf is LeBron, and it still has the plastic on it. I think I killed him.
Favorite movie?
The Godfather 1 and 2.
About Godfather Part 2. Which is the scene or the moment or the phrase or the quote you like more from the movie?
Oh, from The Godfather. It's too many different phrases and too many different lines in that movie to just categorize one.
But which is the one which inspirates you, represents you more?
I mean, each movie is 9 hours long. I mean, what do you want me to do? I mean, there's so many. I don't know. I'll let you pick one and I'll roll with it. It's a great trilogy.
That's fucking hilarious. Still has the plastic on it.
Oh, fuck.
Let's go out on this, McGee. Scene we'd show to get somebody to watch. What do we think?
Oh, shit. Hold on. I got to look at my notes. What do you have?
I think, all right, so I picked two. I think if you grew up black, but you've never seen this film, But you had like a black, like you had a black dad, like you had, a, you know, your pops was kind of on some old, like he grew up in the 70s, 80s, sort of mature in that way. I think the morning in the kitchen is beat for beat perfect. Pantheon scene. Every time I'm in the kitchen, you in the kitchen is one of the greatest lines of cinematic history. Second one, but I think, so if you wanted to just like hang with some black folks, like you just kind of want to experience what Normandy would be like, the smoke montage, the first, all of them really, but particularly the one where Smokey hands cue the joint, yeah, for the first time, it tries to get him to smoke.
That was my first choice too, actually.
Yeah,
because it was like when they're, that's the what part where they're like shadow boxing and then he punches him in the ribs, and then Chris Tucker does his like Michael Jackson impression, which is like at that point not a thing that he did in everything that he was in.
It starts here, but or wait, no, House Party, gotta go back.
I was wrong, I guess. But no, I want to, that was actually, it was my first choice for a scene as well. What I ended up deciding, though, I think the when Cube is on watch and he's torn between like standing guard for them breaking and entering, yeah, the neighbor and the
Miss Parker.
Then there's the like shit going down with the affair. And then the phone starts ringing and he's just like narrating to himself and just like kind of overwhelmed. That scene. One, I kind of forget that he's not stoned at that point. And then when the scene happens where he smokes weed for the first time in the movie, you're like, oh shit, that scene feels like it makes way more sense if he's stoned, why he's so torn between the three and paralyzed.
No, interesting.
But either way, I think it's just like, I like the way that it's comedically presented and the pacing of it and shit.
Yeah, same. I think because the high anxiety of like, I'm, you know, he's on probation, I'm trying to look out for them, give him the signal, make sure Stanley's not getting back, and I'm also, you know, listening. I think it's just the combination of things going on, yeah, and a little bit of the heightened thing of keeping the arrow, but I like that.
I guess why I picked it is because it, like, seems like it exemplifies that paranoia, that, like, kind of overwhelming one thought jumping into the next thought paranoia of being, like, stoned for the first time or, like, not knowing what that feeling is yet. And just that, like, your mind just, like, jumping from new problem to new problem and, like, overwhelming yourself. Like, it feels like he's doing that in the scene. And then maybe 5 minutes later, he smokes weed for the first time. And I'm like, oh. Also, Smokey's rolled, like, four or five joints over the course of the movie at this point. And, like, you just kind of see weed so often that you forget that Cube isn't also smoking it the entire time.
Right. Yeah. A lot of interesting new problems. Let's talk about some of the first ones in the film's Big Bang coming up after this. Welcome back from break. We're in our focus group segment, breaking down the plot. From here on out, we will be spoiling the film. Starting with the film's opening, the Big Bang, does it sizzle or fizzle? Gotta say this right up top. Talked about a little bit about the improv and the cold open. I'm going to get into the peep script here in a bit, but the film is so greatly improved by the comedic timing and people living in their roles and really breathing life into these characters. And I want to start here with John Witherspoon, who maybe has 20 minutes of screen time in the entire film.
Yeah.
Maybe even less. And fucking lights this film on fire. Like, career defining performance in the 20 minutes that he spends here,
yeah,
with the opening line, like him at the we do get a little first time he's in the bed when he's sleeping and, you know, give me all the and all the fries that you can give me, but his introduction, like it proper to the film, is like lights the screen on fire for 5 minutes in this with every time I'm in the, and it goes longer. If you watch the special features, the scene actually goes, I mean, he's given a lot of, you know, all the food that's in there that Craig is eating,
yeah,
all the hog moss. Like, I love pig's feet. Like he's doing and all that. There's a little bit in the script, but a lot of it is John. And a lot of it is him bringing that timing to it. A lot of him, and so much of the smacking of the lips and the awkward phrasing and pausing. Like the first time As oh, I'll get to it in my shot for shot. The first time we raise up and settle on his face, and then we cut, and he still hasn't even said anything. He's just smacking his lips, eating grapes, looking at Greg in the fridge. And then finally, with the every time I'm in the kitchen, you in the kitchen, and then just lets that sit there for a second. Just lets that, just holds that meat for a second. And then with the goddamn refrigerator, like his the timing of his phrases, his cadence in here. Yeah. It's just fucking chef's kiss. Like, and if you've lived with a black father, this is the closest I can get to you to what it feels like on a day-to-day. To where it's just like, to where it's just every little fucking thing. It's just an art. There's no right move. Everything is a little, it's an attack. It's like that. Hey, do this before that. I got some more. Like, it is so perfect. It is so perfect. It is so perfect in the way they did this. Chef's kiss to the opening of this film. I hung on that scene because I think the kitchen is a lot of, you know, how we get to know the family, getting to know Anna Marie Hausford, getting to know Regina yeah. King, and everybody's dynamic. You could define, you know, John Witherspoon by food. You could define the mother by like comfort or sort of that those maternal sort of that the maternal sort of safety a little bit, like Q constantly goes there to kind of confide into.
Well, she sucks shit just as much as everybody else. She's hilarious. With her making the big ass breakfast for herself and she's just talking shit about the other women. She 100% is taking swings as much as everyone else in this movie.
I'm more saying from Cube's point of view, like Cube sort of
she's talking shit about Cube at the table, like
that is funny.
Siding with the sister,
the sister.
She's just as fucking like swinging right there with everybody else. I don't think they use her. That's one of the things that I think this movie is strong at. Which is weird that like fucking Regina has just absolutely nothing to do, but the mom early is so, though. Yeah, but I think the only reason it's so noticeable is because everybody else is so rich and textured. Like John Witherspoon, like you said, is just lighting the screen on fire. Mm. Like the mom is just fucking, like they're not making her do just stereotypical, like, here's your orange juice and waffle and let me kick you out the door. Like she's making the big breakfast for herself and then being like, I don't know, like fucking eat some cereal. Well, like cereal water will be good for you.
Put some water on it. Won't hurt nothing.
Won't hurt nothing. And her talking shit about the neighbor is one of my favorite bits too, where she just like, ugh, look at her. She should be ashamed of herself.
Her okay, her line reading of okay.
It's genius. Genius.
Okay. Genius.
Okay. Just through fucking clenched teeth. That's what I mean. Like this, the opening, I feel like it gives everybody so much to do that Regina only stands out because of how rich everyone else is, that it's like her, not that she, you know, fails at it.
I agree.
She doesn't have as much material.
She's probably the thinnest out of the family. I think there is.
Even
in that first scene, like we get a little bit with the boyfriend and obviously when her homegirl comes over to do her hair, the brother, sister. So, but but continue. You're going to say even.
Yeah.
You had a thought.
Oh, I was going to say even the lighting in this opening scene, though, like the set feels like it could, if it was lit poorly, it would look like a TV show really, really badly. Because it's just a very like studio looking house in a way that looks very still authentic to like Southern California, obviously. But I can feel the ceilings are high enough to like put some lights in there a little bit. But the lighting is just interior. So.
Because I know the exteriors, obviously, they were shooting. They shoot in where F. Gary Gray grows up. As a matter of fact, where the later on in the film where Debo knocks out Red, that's where Gary, that's his house. That's the childhood home he grew up in.
Oh, the interiors shoot. Are 100% studio, though.
Yeah, but those,
I can tell. You can feel it.
Yeah.
But the lighting on it is
that he loves, which right. I do too.
And like that's, I think that he shoots the shit out of it so well that I don't care that I know it's a studio, just because it's like this feels like they're really using that extra amount of control to really like craft like some like contrast and depth in every frame that is just makes it just like a. It, like as much of it's nostalgic for like the 90s in its like culture and position, like just even the film grain and the the depth Great. Of the frame that's shot in a way that like comedies don't really like luxuriate over the depth of color in the way that this film does. That it does like the neighborhood proud in every respect. Like it feels authentic to like standing in the Southern California sun.
Let's talk about some things we had caught in this viewing that we hadn't noticed before. Let me just open with this because I think there's a universal one. I'm wondering if you've noticed in Joy's bed, this is Cube's girlfriend, Joy, Paula J. Parker. Did you notice in the scene with it, "You ain't got to lie, Craig, you ain't got to lie," another famous quote. Did you notice another dude in her bed during that scene? This is a universal sort of everyone notices after a few viewings. But if you go back and take a look at that scene in the bed lying next to her, because it looks like it's just a pile of clothes, but it's a dude, but he's like facing towards the wall. In her bed as she's accusing Cube of cheating during that scene. So
I'm pulling it.
You guys, viewers, if you check that out, that's one to keep an eye out for. One I caught, particularly on these later viewings, as I'm really, really kind of honing in, because I've always loved how this film was shot. I think Jerry Lively and F. Gary or DV.
Oh, shit, there's just a dude right there. Sorry.
You see him?
Yeah, that's just like, it's not even a little bit hidden. It's just a dude's pants, like, right? He's just wearing slacks. What the fuck? Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I did not expect it to be. His arm is right there.
Yeah, yeah. That's a universal one that people love.
That is not even a little hidden. Yeah. It's like right behind her face.
But no one notices it first. Like, for whatever reason, you don't really.
I watched this like three times. Yeah. I didn't notice it.
You didn't pick it out. Yeah, but that's what everyone comes to. The one I picked out, let me just stop being so long-winded. Low car mount shots or low mounts for this film always represent character or like characters that are some kind of antagonist, some kind of danger. Love that. I'm not sure. We see it with Hector. We see it. We'll talk about it with my shot for shot moving on. But we see it with Worm. We see it with Hector. We see it with obviously Debo. So I love the low car mount or low mount shots representing danger in this one. And the other one, I don't know why it just never occurred to me, but Big Worm threatening to kill Smokey in front of like 7 12-year-olds is beyond hilarious to me. I don't know why I never picked up on that. I was like, there's a bunch of kids around here.
I'm gonna be here. I'm gonna kill you and him.
Oh my god, classic. Let's jump into a little peep the script here, McGee.
Straight West Coast style. Peep the script.
I have to hit you with this. This is Peep the Script, where E goes page diving in these scripts to show you what these films is working with. The revision I told you was from May 26th of 94. This is so interesting to me because just the creative process, how this film developed. Cube's original reason for getting fired for his day off was maybe not exactly what you expect. It was a little bit more convoluted. Clearly, he's working for a UPS-type company or delivery-type company. You see red and the browns.
Yeah.
And they have the sort of like a delivery-like logo. Apparently on his day off in the script, what he does is he's driving into work to go pick up his check, gets cut off by an old woman and curses her out. And that woman ends up being related to his boss or something of that nature. And that's the reason why he gets fired, which right? For stealing boxes and once you go make a clubhouse, which has been classic, so the simplicity, children, like to see how they sort of prune this, this bonsai here, you sort of make art, you sort of cut this, cut that, stealing boxes so much cleaner. I love this. What about you, McGee? Would you have kept the original or is this satisfied?
It's funny because that was one of the things that I wrote down was I was like, did he actually steal that? Like they kind of leave it ambiguous as if he actually did the thing. Because even the one time that they talk about the footage, he was like, yeah, it kind of looks like you from the back. And then nobody like confirms or denies it. It just hangs. So I feel like it's left ambiguous, weirdly. I don't know.
in the script, he's vindicated by the end. He does get a call from his supervisor to tell him that, you know, they made a mistake and he gets his job back. And this is more part of him. You know, he defeated the dragon. He got the girl. He gets his job back.
Yeah.
Heroes.
Except he didn't do anything. They just like were like, ah, shit, right. My bad.
Exactly. But they do. That is one of the things that they cut, they sort of prune in this one. The other thing, too, is him getting a job or being more stressed about being out of work is more of a thing in the script. They actually go to the health club that they're talking about earlier. So they opened that already, like the health club down on 108th in Normandy. There's a scene in there where they go and Cube tries to get a job down there. His anxiety about being, jobless is a bit more of a thing in the script. But they ended up sort of hacking that away, sort of pulling that back. And the ambiguity, how does that work for you? Do you like it more? Does it fit more into, like, everyone's a little bit morally gray in this film. Does that feel appropriate to kind of keep it?
I like the moral grayness of everybody because it does feel like they're able to do these like kind of heightened jokes and not lose the sense of reality because everybody is not acting like cartoon characters. Even if there's like heightened reactions or heightened physics or like, you know.
Or they are like
whatever.
Ezell is probably a little cartoonish, but I see what you're saying in terms of.
There's still depth in the way that like they make complicated decisions to.
I steal, you know, I don't kill. That kind of thing.
Yeah. So like, I guess, sure. But like,
let's talk about sandwiches, McGee. Compliment sandwiches.
Yes,
you go first because you mentioned Cube's performance. Love Cube's performance in this one. I think him and there's a lot of anxiety with Cube going into this film. Obviously, he's putting up a lot of the money, so the studio can only say so much. I mean, other ones were outright denying them in the script, but. New lines like, you know, Cube's the scariest black man in America right now. You know, him doing a comedy. He is coming off of, an amazing performance in Boys in the Hood, but we're not sure if we can buy him as, you know, Mickey Rooney or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, is he going to be able to like sell comedy well? Who knows? I, for one, thinks he plays that James Cagney sort of angry Archie Bunker grouch,
okay,
lovable curmudgeon,
kind of
beautifully
just doofus.
I don't know if I would even say so much doofus, like, because I would more ascribe that to Smokey, but I do think he's quick to anger. But he is very sensible in how he approaches, you know, certain problems. Even if he's not quick to react to them or do anything about them, maybe he's a bit on the lazier side. At least maybe the day after you get fired, you're not immediately jumping to look for another job. But maybe you do deserve a day. Like, let me just hang out for a little bit, but.
It's a classic, like, big guy, little guy setup.
But yeah.
They craft it really, really well.
Absolutely. But the meat, the line reading that I absolutely hate, and I've hated even since I was a kid. Like, I knew it was bad acting, I shouldn't say bad acting. It was a performance note that didn't necessarily work for me tonally. The second line reading, after Smokey gets back, we talked a little bit earlier about he's threatened to be killed in front of 7 12-year-olds, and he's coming back and he's like, Cube's asking him, what did he say? And he's like, oh, no, not, no. And then he goes, no, what did he say? He goes, what? He goes, what'd he say? like the second what'd he say, what'd he say? Like, I need another beat of that, man.
Yeah.
I need another take of that because I do not like the second. Always to this day, that's bothered me, the second what'd he say. We could have got away with the first one. I don't think we needed the second one. It feels like you had some performance notes along that line.
It was the same line. I mean, I think all of the lines that I took objection to, you would have equally worked with Ice Cube just mean mugging. Like you said, like, he's like kind of got, if he just like kind of snapped into that, like, just like fucking, and they like, you know, kind of play off the comedy of that, of like him just but you know, using the mean mug to get what he wants now and then, like do a little camera push on it or something if you really want to emphasize it. But there, just every one of those little lines where he really tries to dial it up, it just feels like he's thinking too much.
I'm afraid to dive into that because I think that you're going to start stepping on some lines I love. I want to dive into that, but I'm afraid. I'm afraid of which one
you mean. It's only when he tries to sound tough, which is wild, because it's not me trying to say that Ice Cube isn't tough, obviously. But I think he's thinking too much about trying to sound tough.
Like, come on, Debo Solly, like that. Something like that bothers you? Come on, Debo Solly, man. Like that one?
That's a good... I like that. I don't have to dig too hard. I can hear him thinking about dialing in exactly how tough he wants to sound. He doesn't want to sound too tough that he sounds scary because it's a comedy, but he wants to still sound tough enough that people are taking him seriously. And so he like tries to find a weird middle spot, and I think he thinks about it too much. But that's just me hyper-analyzing. Obviously, I don't think this is an actual problem with the movie.
I don't think you're 100% wrong. I think the lines work a lot better for me than they do for you. I'll just say that. But I don't know if you're 100% wrong in that critique or analysis, because there's a scene I want to pull, or at least draw your attention to, that I think maybe lends credence to that. That's always been interesting to me, and it's when Debo first gets to the porch and he pocket checks Smokey, but he just asks Craig what he has. And there's almost like there's a line to where it's like, we can't punk Q out like Debo can't grab on Cube in the way he would do Smoke, because he has to be somewhat of the protagonist at the end of the film that we can believe him as being tough enough to take on Debo.
Yeah.
And I think part of you
really
saying like how he's analyzing, like I can't be as tough as Debo, you know, in these certain moments, like Debo has to be our baseline of like bully on this block. And so maybe he's trying to adjust his performance for that. But I think that's an interesting note. Let me talk to you about something. So I guess to round out that sandwich, please.
I was going to try and round out the sandwich with one of my favorite Cube line reads.
Oh,
just
please,
to give him some credit after I've been talking shit.
Yeah.
When he dusts himself off, then that takes the perfect amount of silent pause, and then leans back over and goes, "Do I still look high?" is so fucking funny.
Yes.
He waits the exact right amount of time to like fuck with his shit and then just sit there still for a second and then ask, and it fucking cracks me up every goddamn time. It's so perfect. It's so brilliant. That's where I'm like, oh, you're a fucking genius. Like, I see.
I'm gonna talk about I got a moment like that, but coming up with DJ Pooh's Red, a character later on. I love this. Let's take this film into the Grover Cleveland presidential time machine. See if it works in a different decade. I'm almost afraid, McGee. I don't really have much for this, but what I do want to say is the thing that's been teased forever, and we will be watching all the Fridays. I don't give a damn what Nat says. All of them are classics. First one has a lot of heart, but the second two are fucking classics as well. Second one's next Friday. The third one is a Friday after next. Cat Williams comes from, like, he's the breakout star of that film, the comedic breakout talent of that film. Playing the Money Mike, or I forget what his name is. Money Mike. After that film comes out, immediately there was going to be the complete the
quadrilogy.
Yeah, it's a quadrilogy. I don't know if that's the right word.
Quartet.
Quartet of films. There we go. Was last Friday. It was going to be the last film, obviously, in the Friday franchise.
What, the prequel?
The capstone of all of the of the.
I know, but is it a prequel joke or
No. It's a sequel to last. Obviously, it's the last film in the franchise, not a prequel.
Yeah,
continuing the story.
You get my bit there with the if saying last Friday means the Friday that happened before.
Oh.
you missed my bit.
I missed it. I was thinking of you because I've always thought last in the numerical sense of the word. Like we're having that like last going back like last before.
So we should do a Last Friday that's a prequel.
That's interesting. Last Friday.
And it's a pun.
Yeah, I like that. No, it's going to be a Last Friday sequel where he's bringing back, you don't know these characters yet, but he's bringing back all the villains from all three films. He was bringing back Chris Tucker as well, which is another interesting thing because Chris Tucker doesn't return to the franchise, sort of abandons it after some a religious...
you can just leave it there.
And so... you know, works with Brett Ratner and does the three.
Oh my god,
fucking Rush Hour films, but can't return Man, Friday. Don't, hey,
I can't in my heart of heart. The Rush Hour films are one of those things where it's like, I know it's bad for me, but I can't not love it.
But I'm afraid that this turns. I think people have gotten a little too old, obviously. We've lost a lot of key characters. Rest in peace, John Witherspoon. Rest in peace, Tawny Lester. So I'm a little afraid this turns into like Coming to America. That's too numerical to America if they do Last Friday at this point. Yeah. With my guess. Like I don't know if the comedy, what made it so special. The, I don't know if they got, I don't know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be.
Because what this movie, what works so well about this movie, it, like we've been saying, is like the authenticity and its groundedness in like real experiences by human beings. Where if we did Last Friday now, that sentiment would be replaced by getting the people from the other movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Playing on it's like the, they would play it on. Remember yeah. This.
It would just yeah. be a shortcut to like, look, it's the same guy from before.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why those don't work. Little priest, Buddhist, and rabbi. Let's hurry up quick, McGee, because we're in an hour. And we still got two more segments.
We can cut plenty of this.
Yeah. Where do we judge our friends that get us into a little bit of bullshit? Where do we place the morality of the friend that's just like, it's not super crazy, but they get you into a little something spicy every now and again? Where do you mean? And I know you've that can go off the rails real quick. Not real quick, over a prolongated period of time.
That's just the price you pay. That's the price you pay for having a good time, baby. Sometimes you go off the rails a little bit. No, I think that, like, for me personally, those are the most valuable people to have in a friendship. Because, like, I'll be a safety prude. And, like, then I'll pair up with the, you know, a little bit of a dirtbag. And, like, we keep each other balanced. Like, it's I think the... You need those people to get you out of your comfort zone and move it a little bit. And yeah, you're going to have to bail them out every once in a while. But like, that's just the price of having a good time for most of the other nights.
And sometimes the price is $200 and you better have it before 10 o'clock. Let's get to Under the Lights coming up after this. All right, welcome back from break. We're going Under the Lights, breaking down performances, starting with some of the best, like I said, best performances. I want to talk about this bit here. It's going to blend a little bit into multiverse, but what you may not know is when Pooh and Cube are writing the script, it was always intended to be a Pooh and Cube buddy feature. Like I said, Pooh, you know, produced a number of tracks for Cube in his past. He's very much a versatile talent in himself. He plays Red in this film. Again, Red's the one that works for you. If you're like, oh, they was clowning you at work today. Oh, hey, my grandmama gave me that chain. Like that's Red. That's DJ Pooh. Excuse me. I've always tried to imagine what Pooh Smokey would be. And again, he's cast as that. New Line doesn't feel like they're already taking a chance on Cube. On this production, we need to get a higher profile name, or at least a higher profile comedian in here. They go and seek out Chris Tucker. Obviously, Chris Tucker makes his name and blows up from this performance. An incredible Smokey performance. I'm gonna argue, but I've always tried to think like if things had worked out the way they imagined, what would Pooh's Smokey be like? And there's the reason why I feel like it could have worked and he may have been able to pull this off is because of this scene right here of when we first see Red after getting knocked out and after, you know, Smokey recounts what happened at the card game and him and his pops pulling up. And, you know, he goes to sit down and he gets up, you know, how's your eye? And then, damn, And they're looking at him like, it's okay. When Debo rolls back up on them for the second time in the day, he goes, what's up, y'all? What's up, Red? Thanks for the bike. Like, after off the line, because we're on a close of Red, thanks for the bike. Watch it again. Go back and watch the scene again. It's genius. His reaction is almost like, it's like a sense memory. Like almost like he's having a Vietnam flashback of getting hit, but he has to remember to like steel himself so that he doesn't react too wildly or upset this fucking wild tiger that's next to him. So when he goes, thanks for the bike, he shudders, but then he steels himself real quick and like just looks off to the horizon. And it is some of the most subtle performance of just like, of someone that's just been harmed and just like trying to keep it together to not elicit the same reaction. It is beautiful. It is a beautiful, beautiful like piece of acting in that close up.
So
absolutely
funny.
Worth it. I suggest everybody go rewatch it. So many other ones, like, please.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think he would have been like, his Smokey would have been a little less manic probably.
Yeah,
like a little. Yeah, I would imagine more right. of the like, kind of like pothead, stoned out, slow, yeah. like pothead yeah. instead of the like hyper,
like a Barney Rubble
energy.
Almost to his Fred Flintstone.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one. Yeah, exactly. Mm. Chris Tucker obviously, you know, has his. I don't think anybody has the same amount of energy as Chris Tucker. Like, he's just the energy level is at a maximum 100% of the time, which works really well for this movie, but it's hard to even imagine it without it.
Yeah. And, you know, now that you're saying that, or that we're talking about performance, the manicness, there is a, I mean, because he, I think the tradition, like we just mentioned, the traditional sort of laid back, laconic kind of character is the pothead. And I think that represents more of what is true to a pothead, but it feels like maybe that's why he smokes so much. Maybe that's why Smokey is because yeah. of the ADHD and because of the manicness. But the way weed, and maybe the larger point, is handled in this film is obviously like it's something like class A, class one drug. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's very
90s.
Right. Mid-90s kind of take on it. Circling back to performances. I mean, everyone. There's... That, and that's the thing about the improv thing that I want to bring up is everyone enlivens a role that if you read the script side by side and you just see Angela Marie Harsford's line that says, okay, you're not thinking about her like cracking her neck over the side of her shoulder, just like, and sort of like just etching it out over her like gritted teeth. Like, okay.
Like, okay. She does,
it is incredible. So you like,
she's like, so funny.
Bernie Mac, the cadence of talking like a black preacher in normal speech, just like what we call that, and 24th and Baptist is a little twin or a little sin, and like how he does that, and then Tucker playing back like that's not in the script, you know, that's your ass, Mr. Postman, as he's watching the video of the German Shepherd attacking the postman, like him laying on the bed, like all none of that's in the script. Like everyone brings so much to their performance and like the 2 or 3 minutes that they have there. Like Red
yeah.
just running across the street and his arms doing like the olive oil shit. Like,
it's so fun. Haven't you referenced that in a previous episode?
I probably remember. Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody had a shitty run and you made me watch that clip.
So fucking funny.
You're absolutely right though. There is just so many little moments where it just, the absurdity, like dial just going up and down, is so much fun. What do you say?
Joanne, Smokey's mom, she has a lot more in the script. You know, a lot more scenes. She's at least a page and a half in the script of shit. And they've completely, you know, her role's gone. But she is cemented with the, you know, don't slam my goddamn door. But beyond that, I've heard my mom go, ha ha, yes it did. Like, just that tone and how she hit that, like that volume. Perfect. Thirty seconds of make it enough.
Yeah.
Care like yeah. shit like that. It was perfect. Felicia. Angela Means Felicia, who goes down in history as one of the most iconic characters in Black cinema, by Felicia, obviously, you mentioned, is knowing that phrase without having seen this film. She and Faison Love get cast before Chris Tucker. Chris Tucker has an audition that goes really poorly. And they want him for the role. Cube wants him for the role. F. Gary Gray wants him for the role, but the studio's a little nervous. His audition went poorly. They liked him in House Party, but obviously the audition went bad. So they're like, well, you know, get your shit together. Come back for a second one because we believe you're right for the role. Angela and Faison coach Chris Tucker. They bring him over to the house. They say they make a big pot of spaghetti. And by the time the spaghetti's done, he was smoky. And they're, you know, they're teaching him about L.A. They're teaching him how people talk, blah, blah, blah. His line readings, the 7/3. I bring that up to say that Angela, just as a character actress, who's actually, I believe she was like a Price is Right, like Bob Barker beauty. So to make her look way that they did, it was, we'll get into the costume design. Sean actually is the costume designer on this film, goes to do amazing work with that design and the hair and makeup. I'll get those names later on, but, Angela as a performer, everything she like, so when she goes up there, you know, what's up, Craig? What's up, Smokey? And she goes to sit. She was supposed to kind of stand like how Bernie Mac delivered that. Her invading their space and just like sitting in between them and doing that. And then you get the authentic, like Chris Tucker, like the damn, as she does, like sits on his arm. Is it like that? Like in the middle, like,
yeah,
her instincts.
She's 100% invading the space. Like, no, like, yeah.
You cherish. So I know, I'm saying all this is a larger point. I'm rambling all is a larger point to say that I know improv, and we've had to talk about improv a little earlier on this month. I know how difficult that is for a script supervisor. I know how difficult that is for a production. People aren't saying the lines consistently. They're not behaving consistently. Things aren't matching the cut. It can be frustrating, but when you trust your performers, particularly with comedians, they're thinking and inhabiting these roles in ways that you can't even, you're not even thinking about. Even as a writer, like I've had my own work spoken back to me in a way where I'm like, I just didn't even think to say it like that. And that's so much sharper. It's like, you have to, in some way, deal with that bullshit to value what other people are bringing to a performance. Now, there is a limit. And obviously, that can get kind of crazy. It's like, I need you to be on book, at least for this one. I'll give you a take. However you want to negotiate that. But I feel like it is so valuable to let people inhabit their role and do something that you didn't think of, that they've been thinking about this character for X amount of days longer than you've, even if you've written it. And they're going to bring something that... We mentioned Bernie Mac doing the singing, like all the little bits here. Angela invading the space here, not in the script. She just did that in the moment on the day. We're keeping that because that's amazing. She knew Felicia in a way that F. Gary, that Cube, that Boo didn't. And I just want to speak to that in the performance.
I think off of that too, like it's a thing we've brought up before. Like we brought up recently when we talked about the newscasters from Dawn of the Dead, I believe it was, where it was like, they were like theater partners that like knew how to riff off of each other. So it's almost like her being intimate enough with Chris Tucker to like have him over for dinner and get him warmed up to this character is also like the level of familiarity that made her comfortable to just like sit on his hand a little bit in the middle of a take and like completely like disrespect his personal space in a way that was appropriate for the character, but like maybe an actress would be a little more like, oh, I don't know this guy that well enough, I don't want him to take it the wrong way, like maybe I shouldn't take it this far. But she, you know, she had him over for spaghetti already. You can kind of fucking accidentally bump him with your ass a little bit to get him out of the way so you can sit on this table that you're now using as a stool. Like just it perfect additions.
I want to talk about our three antagonists, three-headed monster. We'll get through this quickly. Faison Love, every scene dynamite. Every scene he's in, like, I don't want to have to fuck you up, Smokey. I'm going to be here at 10 o'clock on the dot, not 10:03, not 10:36. If you don't have my money or my butt, like, every line, like, I'll cut your balls off and hand them to your partner. Like, every line reading.
And putting on the little visor when he's getting ready to drive away in the ice cream truck. He, like, straightens out the visor and checks himself out in the mirror. Fucking gold.
Amazing in this one. Debo. rest in peace, like we mentioned, Tiny Lester Jr. Debo has lived on in our, Debo lives on in our hearts to this day. Mustard on the beat ho, Debo, any rap nigga, he's a free throw. He still to this day appears in pop culture lore. His jaw, like this, what is it, the unmovable object or the unstoppable force kind of thing? Like he is inhabiting all of that. But his line readings that are so slow and measured, and then he'll pop to a scream, but they're mostly like, "What's up, Smo? What's up, Craig? What you got?" Like how slow and undrawn, and that was part of the concern with F. Gary Gray is just like, if I cast Tiny, are people even going to understand what he's saying when he goes something like, "Hey, Craig, if you hear some." Whistle. Like, if you hear someone like pronounce or announcing it whistle in the way that he's done it. Wait, but it's almost we were talking about the Princess Bride and we're like the trade off of casting Andre the Giant in this and like his line read, but they're so unique to him that they just make everything so much more special. Tiny Lester in every line read in this one makes this his dead eye makes this film. His line read, just like his bald head, his look makes this film. I love Tiny. Debo, we'll see him again a little later on in another film, but here's where he cements himself, I think, in like the hearts of pop culture as this role of Debo. Mm-hmm. It cannot go understated of just how beautiful this was. Let's jump quickly in here to line reading. McGee, this whole fucking film to me could be a line read. As a matter of fact,
we've talked about so many.
I think I might have a hypercut of just all of my favorite lines on this one. But I gotta say, like I said, I may just have a hypercut of this one, but one that's gonna go so subtle and unnoticed that I have to fucking say, which is the amazing lived-in quality of this film, is after Smokey, so when Hector comes by for the second time, and Smokey's like, you know, fuck you, Hector, like, I'm not gonna sell to you, like, you know, get off your ass, like, you know, you're not gonna give me shut up, so he goes to go sell Hector the butt. And we've already heard the story of Smokey, you know, getting out, he hit the angel dust, and he's running down the street in his clothes, but he was in his underwear on that one. When he goes to the car, what Hector, so he hands him the money, what Hector whispers in the transaction, he goes like, yeah, thank you, bro, you got nice legs.
Oh, shit. Oh, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. I didn't hear that.
Thanks, you got nice legs.
Yeah, nice legs.
That's why he goes, fuck you, at the end of that. His improv of that one, because that's not in the script. And again, is it in the later version? Because some of the ones I got, I have this, I think it's the sixth draft. Maybe it appears later on. But if that was improv, my fucking God. To clown someone subtly from a scene that we've seen earlier, to sort of tie the reality of there. Hector, that relationship's incredible. At the end of the film, Cube's 7:30. Incredible. Incredible line to go out after Debbie's asking what time he's going to be or what time is he getting up. 8:30 to the 7:30. Incredible beats. Let me toss it to you, McGee. Anyone that stuck out to you in your...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we've been talking about John Witherspoon a bunch. The payoff of like all of the terrible mouth sounds for the entire movie. And then when he fucking just comes storming in the house and just stands there defeated and just like, I got bit in the ass today, son.
My stinking ass dog. I said, please, Mr. Doggy.
It's like the payback for having to listen to all those mouth noises for so long. It's just like, yeah, you know what? You should get a bit in the ass today. This is the catharsis like I didn't know I needed.
It felt like more payback from the I choke a dog and I put my foot up his ass and all day my foot's up his ass.
he's definitely playing it like he knows he's gonna like it, he's playing like a movie villain that is gonna die in a volcano, and you're, the audience is supposed to feel good about it. So he's really playing up how shitty he is at the beginning. Like making the man stand there while you're taking a shit in the first place is so out of
pocket.
I smelled
your shit for 22 years. Now you can't smell mine for 5 minutes.
Just stand on the other side of the door, man. I'll have this conversation from that side of the door. Like, that sucks enough, but like, I'm not going to come in the room with you. That's ridiculous. But yeah, that's what I think.
I ain't trying to be no dog catcher. And then like, his line of, why not? But like, how he like breathes it out. Why not?
He does everything with like such terrible noises. It's incredible. It's an art form.
Oh,
I hate
God.
It, but it's incredible.
Debo's thanks for the bike is incredible. We've talked a bunch about the okay from Anne-Marie Harsford. You ain't got to lie, Craig is only written once, but that's what's beautiful about Angela's performance is her coming in twice with the you ain't got to lie, Craig, you ain't got to lie. I mean, just so much quotables. Yeah. This whole film is full of quotables. Let's jump into please.
I mean, I already mentioned the do I still look high is, I think, one of my favorite deliveries. But the older the berry, the sweeter the juice back and forth was also one of those. It's just like, it's obviously like the hand of the writer. Like, yeah.
Was she blacker than the motherfucker too?
Yeah. Fuck, it's, and that one's hilarious too. This is just, it's fucking good shit. Good shit.
Costume designer Sean Burton, no relation to Sean McGee. I'm going with the iconic cube and smoke fit of the flannel, the black jeans, the forces of the navy. They're in, what's interesting too, just as a side note, they're in a Crip neighborhood in this one. Not to say that everybody wasn't cooperative and happy to have them on set, but obviously, you know, you don't want to go in there and you don't want to go in there with your bright red on. So people on the set, everyone's styled and sort of at least reds are there's no reds in the costume design, but the subtle ways of the shades of blue in this one, I do find to be harmonious, particularly like the villains, like the blue flannel of Debo, paired with like the blue house coat of like Stanley, paired with like the blue of John Witherspoon. There's so many interesting, like the only one that people that give with maroon or sort of like a red tone is Felicia, which I find interesting is like a color theory thing. But I do like how the color palette of the film is like, it's almost like a color swatch. Like we're just going to paint with these four or five colors and there's a harmony to that, to the image. Love what he did. Cause this look between Cube and Smokey is iconic. Like kids dress up as Halloween in this, such an easy costume to throw together with the gray and white flannel with the chain and the blue hat and the chucks. One of the iconic fits of Hood films.
It's a far cry from the neighbor's like silk ascot and smoking jacket or whatever the fuck he's wearing. But that's what I would be wearing. that's the only fit I'd be wearing.
Telling kids to stay off your grass. welcome back from break. We're going behind the lens, breaking down the film's craftsmanship and its curtain close. You can follow this segment and our last one, the best fit segment, in our show notes where we post them for free on the Patreon. You do not need to sign up or pay for it, but while you're there, we do appreciate it if you do. Starting with my first shot, I don't know if I, maybe let me clarify here. Some of the storyboard process that F. Gary Gray went through with this film was to take a camera out and just shoot the whole film with a couple of his friends posing as Craig and Smokey and sort of just build out the visual language of the film like that. I think it was so valuable because this film is running up against a 20-day production schedule, all kind of budgetary constraints, his first film. But having shot it prior to this one, just like knowing we're going to shoot on this block, what are so many interesting angles that we can cover with this one? He has a history as or a background as a music video director. He shot, you know, we mentioned Today Was a Good Day with Cube. He shot that music video, which Pooh also produced on. So he obviously has an eye. He knows what he wants. He's been working here and there. Him getting his first feature to do this, I think it was so valuable for him to kind of take that step to just shoot the film and like let me really concretely like figure out how I want to move around this space. I think that's how you get shots like this one in my first one when you're just thinking about shooting a kitchen in an interesting way or an interesting reveal in a kitchen. And we've talked about character reveals in the past here. Some of my favorites being, I'm sorry, one of my favorite in the film being this one of John Witherspoon. Two things about this shot that I love is this real close on Cube as he's in the refrigerator closing the door revealing John. And then as we move up in this shot, him just, you know, the teeth and him biting into the grapes and him just looking and not even saying anything before his line. And then the cut to Cube just looking confused as all hell and befuddled is probably the one of my funniest reverse shots in cinematic history. Like, I will look at this. Like just as a laugh, just the still of Cube looking and not saying anything as his pops eating grapes is one of my favorite shots of all time. I love this reverse shot set up by this incredible reveal of John Witherspoon in this scene.
They do, the sound design in this scene is really ridiculous too, because it's like, before you even get the reveal with the fridge door closing and seeing his face there, you just hear the smacking sounds already. Like eating noises come in before you actually see him. So you like hear him coming and it just gets louder and louder. And then the fridge door shuts and he's just right fucking there, just invading your space. It's phenomenal. It's fantastic.
What'd you got for us, McGee?
Actually got one.
This used to be one of my desktop, whatever the desktop backgrounds that, you know, like this was my desktop background for a while in college.
This one of the wheel.
Yeah. The Dayton, the ice cream truck on Dayton's.
I'm going to do that one after you do yours. Cause it's like 1, 2, 3. Because you do the other wheel shots. So I'm going to save that one for after yours.
Oh, okay, okay.
Well, then, but I have another shot I want to talk about.
Okay, please.
there's one shot. I didn't actually send you the screenshot. I'm just kind of winging this. But it's the, it like jibs down from the classic like shoes over the power line when they're going into the corner store. And they're getting a beer with that one guy.
Yeah, he's ill.
The shot stands out to me, one, because their jib operator is terrible. I'm sorry. I'm not going to call you out by name, but it's the shakiest fucking like operating where it's like down, down, down. Like when he's adjusting, absolute awful. But the shot itself is constructed really well where it's like, it's one of those things where you're like, oh, like you really thought this out. Cause it doesn't just jib down from the shoes into the storefront to do your establishing shot. Like, it continues from that perspective and then just kind of like dollies left again in a way where I'm like, oh, actually, like you made me think about the geometry of the camera because I had already caught my eye. Mm-hmm. But in a way where that was something I did on the second watch for sure. Right. The first watch, I was like not paying attention to that. So it was just one of those things where it was just a nice touch where I could see it's impressive that this was his first movie because he's moving efficiently with purpose and like building and staging complex shots when he needs to. And then, you know, just shooting things the old fashioned way and not in a way that looks cheap, just in a way that's efficient.
Speaking of complex shots, moving on to my next one. This is the Smokey telling the story of Devo knocking Red out, coming back for his bike, his beach cruiser. Subtle complexity and just like we're starting shooting the through the bike spokes of this car game. When, again, finding interesting ways to use these three planes to cut up the frame in an interesting way to subtly hint at what we're going at. Kind of create like this these harsh lines, slashing divisions, and Debo sort of being this like villain, and then using the very back plane of Red and his father driving up here, hold my money. creating an interesting look to this driveway through these bike spokes. Something very simple, but I like the layering on this and then the subtle meaning that we get as we move forward with this scene about this beach cruiser. So I think he goes on to handle the film in this way. Just, I didn't think to shoot it in that way. You can find beauty in anything if you think long enough about it and how to stage it. And I thought he created some really, really interesting frames with this one. Frames like this one, particularly on this one. But
it's funny for like a flashback that is meant to be like you're setting up the character, but it is still like pretty fucking, you know, you're like still keeping it comedic as much as possible. But to shoot it like dramatic black and white and add those little touches where you're, you know, shooting things in a dramatic way to match the tone of the dramatic black and white, because they do that in the flashback scene where Smokey smokes the lace joint, mm-hmm. and he's like, when he's like, you know, shaking in the chicken coop, mm-hmm. or whatever, like that's really dramatic black and white too. And they like mm-hmm. commit to a really, really deep, hard contrast ratio, right. that is not, you know, they didn't just take the color footage and just put a black and white filter on it. Like
right.
they committed to shooting this at this like very, very hard contrast ratio. That's not shot like anything else in the film. So it's funny that they, when they chose to go dramatic with it, even if it is for a goofy joke where he's hiding in the chicken coop or like this really cartoonish, like he punches him and he flies through the air. Like he might as well have done the like, yahoo-hoo-y sound effect as he flew.
Like Wilhelm scream.
yeah. Like so like as heightened as those moments are, it's still shot in this like really like interesting dramatic way, which is just like, it adds to the timelessness of it all.
It's definitely lit in that, or I'm sorry, not lit, handled in that dramatic of a way, but I think some of the sound design cues sort of lighten it up or take the piss out of it a little bit, like the Jaws cue for Debo, and the dun 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 dun, like in the background of this scene. What was the other one that you mentioned? It was the chicken coop one. Just like fucking having grit. So it is this dramatic lighting and this is like a heavy contrast kind of way, but him just going like,
yeah, him making bird sounds.
It's just hilarious. So all right, I talked about this a little earlier, and this is the, my third shot is the low mounts. Some are the car, some are on the bike. I love these. I love these so much. I think they create such a dynamic way to introduce villains in this one. A lot of it is hip hop video, sort of, you know, Yo MTV rap like feeling to it, particularly with the bike and everything. But so many little dynamic things to have your background tell a story while you're sort of stuck in this area here, telling a story with your background and your midground. You have this stuck force perspective, and you're able to kind of cycle into a story in this one. And some of it's you're using sound cues, and you know that the villain's approaching, so you're using this dramatic music, and it's almost a villain reveal by way. Really quick, it's almost like a villain reveal by way of like. Seeing two other characters reacting to him approaching. So we're with the villain the whole time, but it's an interesting reveal for this character. But so much of
you're
this,
you're seeing them by reputation and movement. Like you're seeing their aura, but you're not seeing them. So it is the, like, yeah. like you're letting your imagination fill in the details. Very fun.
So, Combo Craft stars a line like the three of these guys, Mike DeLuca, New Line. Everybody involved, catching Tucker at the right time. So many faces we've seen. Regina King in this one very early. Debo makes him, Tiny Lester makes himself a star. Just, I feel like they just caught everybody at the right time with the right script. Hot off the heels of Boys in the Hood. So we're hungry for a little something different. This is a pantheon. Who?
What's his name is in the background of the black and
Michael
white
Clark
shot
Duncan is Michael Clark Duncan is it like no but again and what's so crazy is on the day he asked him for a line and he didn't give it to him he just like write you for an extra But they just didn't. Didn't know what Michael Clark. You know who else is another one? A sneaky one that you didn't know? Megan Good at 14 years old. I think 9 or 11. Don't quote me. Is Megan Good's a little girl? She's the little girl in this thing where she's like, where she's, you know, I hate him. Or at the,
at the ice cream truck.
Ice cream truck. Yeah, that's Megan Good.
That's wild.
Yeah, a lot of early faces in this one. Got a lot of people at the right time. So, absolute classic. I want to say something to Ernest Troust, music to our ears, a composer here. Like I mentioned, the sound design is so beautiful in this one. This isn't music, but, you know, just as we're talking about sound. Car alarms for cars that don't need it, like Red run into his car, but the car alarm goes off so he can get into it. Smokey's car alarm going off after he can't stop it, the brake won't stop. Like, alarms is jokes, doors is jokes.
Smokey's car is one of the best props. Like, yeah. It's such a perfect representation of a car. Like, it's not shitty. It doesn't look like somebody made it shitty. It looks like that car got shitty. Like, does that make sense? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Like the hood just like rattling a little bit out of place. Like it's like little details where it's like the hood's vibrating a little bit more than the rest of the car. Like it's not quite set all the way. Mwah. Just chef's kiss.
But the amount of music on here, we got Dre, we got Cypress Hill, we got Zapp and Roger, we got Jay, I can't remember what old boy's name was. Anyway, a lot of music in here that would cost a lot more than what it feels like they paid for. A lot of people doing favors. A lot of L.A. coming out to support a young director. I know McGee hates that.
Yeah.
No, he hates to hear that.
why did I get painted as anti-L.A.? I mean, one tiny little, not even criticism about L.A. in general. It was more like less to fucking Santa Monica.
You know what? I'm going to be honest with you. I'm just going to be straight honest with you. I think McGee's probably being a little kinder to me. Than I think he's turning up the charm maybe 15% on his reaction here. I'm very curious if you would ever watch it again. Because I don't suspect you would. I think you'd be a little nice to me on the episode. But
I don't think I will.
Oh, my God. How do you not launch Friday again?
I've enjoyed it every time I've watched it. Yeah, I think the Wayne's World comparison is like, I understand exactly why this movie is as important for you as that movie is for me. And by the same token, I don't expect you to ever put on Wayne's World again.
But this is dwarfs and like, Wayne's that's World fine. In pop culture. Impact.
What'd you say?
There's no this dwarfs Wayne's World.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I'm not comparing them like that. They're 100% one for one comparable. I just mean in comparison of our where they How the movies you? Are positioned in the two of our lives specifically.
there's no way.
Like, well, that's for me. Like I know Wayne's World as well and deeply as you know.
But this
was
objectively perfect. This is written.
I mean, the culture at large agrees more with you than me. Let's be honest. This movie is definitely culturally beloved, and for a reason. No, I mean, That's not to say I dislike this movie at all. It's just to say that I think it.
Moving on.
Hold on. It's more about the timing for me and when it hit me.
Got a little too old for this one.
I think it hit me the first time when I was too young for it, and then now it's hitting me when I'm too old for it. So it's just not as important to me, but it's not to take away from how well it's made.
One of the best movies of all time, one of the best comedies of all time, one of the first Black Stoner comedies. So much heart, incredible. DJ Pooh, Ice Cube. Today was a good day. The day we recorded this episode was a good day. Talk about some more good days coming up in our month of the 420 special here at MMDub.
Some real bad days, a bad trip coming for us next week.
Coming this April to video stores everywhere.
All right, next week we are watching 1985's Brazil, directed by Terry Gilliam. This is written by Terry Gilliam, starring Jonathan Pryce, Kim Greist and good old Bobby De Niro.
Tony Thrice.
So I sent you the poster. What'd you say?
It was worth it. Never mind. okay. Yeah. So you just sent me the poster here, and it's of a man who is in a sort of a dystopian metropolis type of city, and his mind, what looks like his maybe mind palace, his dreams. There's flying Pegasus, and I can't tell what that is. Is that a train in the back? Car? Somebody holding a, looks like a chief, or he's having, he has a vivid imagination that's contrasting his dystopian surroundings. The tagline is, it's all about, oh, I'm sorry, let me pull this down here. I can't read it. It's all about flights of fancy, or I'm sorry, all about flights of fantasy and the nightmare of reality, terrorist bombings and late night shopping, true love and creative plumbing. It's only a state of mind, Brazil. So admittedly, I know a little bit about this in terms of it being sort of a workplace comedy, a little bit of a dystopian workplace misadventure, to where he is having these vivid dreams of being some kind of hero, but his day-to-day life is under this bureaucratic nightmare. So what I'm imagining happens in the film Brazil is, so his imagination has to get the best of him in some way. And so I'm thinking in some way he's given an opportunity, but he's unable to control or differentiate between his dreams and actual reality. And so, like, maybe his vivid imagination or what he imagines going on, like how he tries to liven up his surroundings, sort of conflict with what's actually happening. I'm not sure what that would be. So maybe he's a salesman, an ad salesman, and instead of doing it in like the Obey, John Carpenter, They Live version of it, he's becoming much more like lively and imaginative, and he's disrupting the norm. And so his advertisements are going on to like inspire people to like reconnect with their humanity and their lives and what it means to be human. And he's getting a little too much. He's acquiring too much power this way. And so then the man comes down to cut him off at the knees, because he's advertising too damn well. he's reminding people what it means to be human. It was coke ads.
Oh, fucking shit. I love this movie. This is a sweet movie that you've just pitched here. It is so many different ideas combined. I love it. No, that's not the movie, but I mean, it's not like terribly far. There's some things that if I just say no flat out, you're going to get upset with me next week, but well, I'll play into the bit. It's fine. But this is the log line. Not so far off, but a bureaucrat in a dystopian society becomes an enemy of the state as he pursues the woman of his dreams.
No. Okay. All right.
So there are definitely some elements that you're on the nose for, but I guarantee there's going to be some stuff where you're just like, I'm along for the ride, baby. I guess this is where we're going now. This is my pick for our 420 special, because I think you have two kind of choices when you're talking about weed movies. You have movies about weed that incorporate it as part of the plot and adventure, and then you have movies that are just fun to watch while very stoned. And this is definitely a movie in the latter category, where there's things that are happening and just successions of faces that pop up that you're familiar with and are just kind of fun to see, and then scenarios and visual ideas and combinations of practical effects that are just send you on a trip of just like, wow, and how did they think of that, and how did they get to that solution? How did they know they were going to get to that solution when they started working on this? Because how? And that's where I this is the kind of movies I like to get real baked and watch.
Hell yeah. Next week. Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplaybox, theme song by Soulspy. Coming soon, folks.